they hit 14. Except for your girl. I don't care if your girl takes another one. I don't care. You've got to help us in the paint. You understand that? Everybody else, how in the world do you lose 20-30? How do you lose her? I don't understand. I look up and she's wide open for a three. Y'all are not locked in on defense. You're not. On the other end, we've got to put the ball on the floor and get to the basket. You got to be strong. You got to play through. No more jumpers. No more threes. Get to the basket. Get to the paint. And you've got to finish. When I'm telling them to throw you the ball, you've got to finish. Do you understand that? You get the ball inside and you got to score. We're missing all kinds of chippies. Grow up. Be women. Because right now, you mean tell you what's embarrassing? We are not the stronger team right now. That's embarrassing. I will not put a team on the court that walks off and they are not the tougher team. That is not an option. That is not who we are. That is not what has got us to this point right now. And the tougher team is not getting whiny and pushy. No! It's being mentally stronger than everybody else out there. And you did not take a playoff. That's all I got for y'all. Come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Zebra Stripes Podcast. I'm Coach Gene Clemens, joined as always by my main man, Whit LeJour.
Man, you get me pumped up with that stuff.
Hey, I'm just, listen, that sound you heard, ladies and gentlemen, Tennessee Volunteers, women's coach, Kelly Harper, who I have a little bit of a crush on, that country accent, that southern accent, is absolutely fantastic. But at the same time, just the amount of passion she was coaching with, she was yelling at those girls, and not one of them looked as if, oh my God. And I think something like that is something that's lost, has been lost to a certain extent in the men's game today. I was just having a conversation with someone with earlier about the Ben Simmons situation, and in this world that we live in where everything is hypersensitive around mental health, I was saying, at what point do we start to build up the defense system so that our mental stronger, so that we're not affected by booze and not affected as much by the pressure or the criticism, to a point that we feel like we need to just I won't say quit, because you say quit in today's society and people get up in arms. You decide that you don't want to be in a certain place anymore because of the way in which they've been critical of you. If you go around, if you go and you say, hey, I'm sick, and then you don't do anything to build up the immunity, even if you remove yourself from the place that you got sick at, aren't you just doomed to get sick again?
Great analogy. Not sure where I want to go with it, other than that I want to see if Kelly's got like a day off coming up where she's got to rest her team. Maybe I can fly her up to Maine, have a little convo with the boys. That would be pretty good.
Yo, she's phenomenal.
Yeah, no. And now she's coaching college-age women, where some of that is going to be both tolerated, but depending on where you're coming from in the Positive Coaching Alliance, more appropriate, right, than maybe at some younger ages. And then I think what you hit on a little bit with your pretty interesting analogy of defense mechanisms and building up immunity is, you know, I go back to the whole trophy kids concept that I first, I think, saw with Brian Gumbel on HBO Sports, you know, and just the whole culture of bringing young people up from an extremely young age where everyone's a winner, everyone gets a trophy and, you know, all that stuff so that, you know, it kind of all feeds into the same thing. And, you know, at a certain point, obviously, it's too much. But as we both know, too far in the other direction is too much also. So I don't know. I that's a tough one. My gut reaction is that in today's world, women are probably more equipped to deal with hard coaching more than young men.
Well, I think there's no doubt that women are tougher. They just tend to be like we've there's this real weird like thing that happened that I grew up with that made it seem as if women were not tough because I think emotions get misconstrued as toughness. Right. And just because somebody cries doesn't mean that they're not tough. Just because somebody cries doesn't mean that they're not mentally sharp. It just means that their emotions came to a level where they were expressed itself through tears. I don't think that has necessarily anything to do with being tough, but somehow along the way, when I was being brought up, That was the going rate. Like, hey, well, women, you know, they're just not as tough. And then everything that I saw subsequent to that was a contradiction of what I had learned. Because everything
you came around 20 years, you came around 20 years after me too, and I would tell you that we're on a subject right now where I might know less than I know about football. I'm not sure. So I want to be careful, but about my knowledge base, but I would say, you know, gender stereotypes obviously played a very, very strong role in all of that. And it was in the dominant culture, male, white male culture to kind of breed that stereotype. Because that way you didn't have to compete for attention, gym time, dollars and cents, et cetera, et cetera. So just like everything else, you know, there's always an ideology to support whatever stereotype we want to support.
So, absolutely. I wonder what would happen if you remember in the tournament bubble that they created, the disparity of the way in which the finances were spent on the men's facilities versus the women's facilities. I just wonder what would happen if the men walked into the facility that the women walked into. Like, what would have been the response? Like, what kind of outrage would we have seen from the men if the men walked into the facilities that the women walked into and were told, hey, this is supposed to be the highlight or the showcase of your sport, but this is what we're giving you. Like, people would have had a fit. There would have been riots. Like,
yeah, well, those are the spoils of the spoiled. So, yeah, all hell would have broken loose. And how can this be? And all of that. You know, I know you're right, and it's tricky, right? Because one of my favorite lines is always, capitalism at its finest. You know, I mean, the bottom line is that, men's football and basketball traditionally have been, you know, the revenue producing engines and whatever makes things go. I don't care what sport we're talking about or anything like that. But once you get into, you know, once you get into a situation where things are based on revenue, then, you know, to some degree, it's not going to be equal. And I'm not sure it should be totally equal either. But in another sense, that's, you know, almost ludicrous, particularly if it's an education, you know, in the field of education, for instance. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I don't think it should be I'm not even saying this in terms of I think that the women should be this and that versus right. what the right. men are. I'm just thinking about the ability to then get past it and continue upon the mission.
Yeah.
Like, I think that men, especially in men's sports today, our young men, just they don't rally as fast as these young women do. They don't just hit the ground and bounce back up. Sometimes they hit the ground and stay there, and you got to grab them and pull them up and smack them on the butt and, you know, give them a couple woo-woos and they're back on the horse then. Whereas you see these young ladies, they bounce and they just boom, back up. Boom, what's next? Yeah.
So it's almost, I mean, again, talking in complete stereotypical gibberish, it's like trading places in an odd twist of fate, you know. I don't know if it's fate, but, you know, men have become everything that they chastised women for, and women have fought with great courage and everything else to become more of what, you know, the male sports society thought sports was about in the first place. So it's kind of a strange twist of fate.
And that's where I am, because how do you make mentally tough people if they never go through anything tough? And I could argue that the reason that we see a Ben Simmons, who has all of the athletic gifts that one LeBron James has, height, athleticism, you know, that he, if you put them next to each other, they look very similar. If you, at the same age, obviously, they look very similar. What's the difference between LeBron James and Ben Simmons? It's what's in between the head. I mean, and what's in between the ears, and it's what's pumping in the chest.
And it's life experience up to that given point.
So that's the part where there's been a built tolerance to have to deal with adversity.
Yep.
There's never been a time since LeBron James was 15 years old that he wasn't expected to be the best thing on the planet.
Right. It probably started long before that too. I don't know.
Yeah, but I watched the before they were, you know, and I think there was like a jump that was made 13 years old, where all of a sudden he was good, and then boom, he was, yo, right. This dude's different. Yep. And right. So, like, by 15, he was the number one player in the country, there was talk then that began about him not even bothering going to high school. I mean, going to college. That was the talk at 15, and he had to deal with that, and then dealt with all of the other stuff that comes with it. Whereas, you know, Ben Simmons was allowed to, because he's not from this country, and maybe doesn't deal with the same level of, you know, scrutiny or fanfare in basketball that a LeBron James would in America, because in Australia, basketball is like third or fourth when it comes to...
Yeah, it's awfully good, though. It's awfully good. We got to be careful you don't throw shade at the Australian basketball.
No. I'm talking about popularity of the sport.
Right.
Okay, Number one is cricket. Number one is cricket, then rugby, then I believe soccer. Cricket, rugby, soccer, basketball. So it's not I'm talking about the level of play. I'm talking about the from the outside.
Yeah, so level of scrutiny.
Yeah. I'm not, trust me. Hey, all my Australian people out there, I love y'all, man. Liz Cambage is that's my boo thing. I love her to death. I love everything about y'all culture. That's one of the places I want to come. No shade on Australia or their basketball. I'm just talking about the level where it comes in. Like in America, everybody knows it's football, it's basketball, it used to be baseball, and so they decided they didn't want to play, you know, and then whatever the other sport is after that. But yeah, so like that type of scrutiny that you come under at such a young age hardens you, and it gives you the ability to deal better. And so with the Ben Simmons, who hasn't really felt that type of pressure until he receives his $100 million contract and is next to arguably the best big man and a top five player in the league, and he makes an all-star team, and now people expect him to behave and to play like a star, and you won't even like attempt stuff that other people like Russell West. It could be argued that Russell Westbrook should stop shooting, and yet he's never been afraid to put it up. Well, look how they came up. Russell Westbrook has a level of protective coating that he's built up over years that's allowed him to be able to perform in spite of all the scrutiny. And unfortunately, Ben Simmons doesn't have that. And
yeah, the only thing I'd add is you know, again, I doubt there's a simple answer. Obviously, I'm gonna plead the fifth on this one. I give you the example of Ryan Leaf and Peyton Manning. Like, how can you ever tell when one person is gonna pan out and the other doesn't when they seem so equal? So I think the Leaf Manning, you know, one is analyzed a bunch. And then obviously the question that I like even more that you raise is the idea of, you know, forget about these stars, but what about just the average kid or you know, whatever that is, the above average kid, the below average kid, the kid that's going to be a high school player, maybe not play beyond that, or maybe that goes on and plays a little bit of college ball, but what's, you know, how is that kid being trained in a way that he's going to be resilient and tough and in all the ways historically that we've said, you know, athletic education prepares you for life? That would be my bigger concern, is like, how are we teaching young people and you know, what are the results of that training and you know, and where's this all going, right? So you know, are we in a country that just does not know how to handle adversity anymore? And the answer may be yes when you talk to a lot of people about it.
Yeah, and I think it all of this rolls into a discussion about a successful mindset. Right, because that's what we were going to talk on. I know I threw you the curveball with, you know, how we came in and everything, but I wanted you to follow my logic on. There's a mindset here, right? There's a championship mindset. There's a winning mindset. There's a I gotta get mine mindset. There's a anything to help the team mindset. There's a I just want to be better than I was yesterday mindset.
And there's a growth mindset that Carol Dweck, the very well-known psychologist out of Stanford, talks about, which is on every successful person's bookshelf, the growth mindset, which basically encapsulates about every quality that you just mentioned and then some.
Reading. I have reading to do, in other words. So
yeah, well, yeah, you're yeah. That's been standard reading almost for but maybe a decade. I can't remember when her stuff first came out, but that's exactly what you're talking about. And you know, it's kind of where a lot of people have been.
Yeah,
and the same old thing, right? Just because you have the theory and you have the antidote and the people that support it, the literature that supports it, et cetera, that now putting it into practice, whole different deal.
Yeah. And I think I went the route of grit on the Angela Duckworth book.
Yeah. Cornerstone. You want to put one on one end of your bookshelf and the other on the other end. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been really into that. And obviously the talent code, trying to unlock the things that make those greats, who they are. So it's like that, but that mindset, what's your thought process on a successful mindset and what makes it up? What does it look like? How does it change?
Well, I mean, again, I think, I like everything you said, but a successful mindset is focused on the future. Actually, to be honest with you, is focused on the present more than anything. And then, you know, looks ahead. If it looks back, it's for the purposes of reflection and learning. It's process oriented. It's not outcome oriented. So failures are every bit the opportunity to learn and grow, as are successes, right? Adversity is a key component that we're hammering on right now, but that's, you know, again, more opportunity. It's just a shift in perspective. And I would say the base shift is from viewing things as outcomes. We get really defensive and we get really, defensive, I guess, when, you know, about our ability to win or what caused our loss or our failure. So, you know, if you can kind of, I think it was Kipling who said it, right? If you can view those two imposters as the same, then my son, you'll be a man. There's opportunity in both. So, that's my quick paraphrase on what the championship mindset might be.
And it's interesting because, again, I went the Ben Simmons route because I felt like it tied together a lot of the things that we wanted to talk about this week. Obviously, with Ben Simmons being involved in the NBA trade deadline and him moving on to New Jersey with James Harden, excuse me, not New Jersey, Brooklyn, with James Harden being traded to the Philadelphia 76ers. I actually look at Ben Simmons and James Harden in very similar lights. I don't think James Harden does well with adversity. I think it's been shown over the years. I'm not saying anything groundbreaking. When he's been the man, and there's been actual expectations for him and his teams, that's when he's come up the smallest. And I think that can't be lost, that every time things haven't gone right and or he has to shoulder some of the blame, that's when he wants out. Or that's when a player gets traded. That's what happened in Houston. Every time that, you know, something happened and all of a sudden there seemed like there was about to be some heat put on James Harden, a player got traded or released or let go. And that's where the attention went. And then he wanted out because now he didn't see those players coming in. He was like, I need to get to Brooklyn because then I can, you know, be with these other guys who are going to take the heat and the scrutiny because of their name and what they do. And I can just be James in the background. And then when Kyrie opts out and KD gets hurt and James Harden has to hold the team down, very similar to what KD had to do last year when Harden and Kyrie were hurt and he put on one of the greatest, you know, exhibitions of basketball I'd ever seen in my entire life over a 4 or 5 game span. You know, when he had to do that, he came up small.
For me, it just goes to show you that super teams aren't for everybody, you know, which means some of this trend, right, is just a trend that, I'm not sure LeBron popularized with the decision, but, you know, you could call the Lakers or the Showtime super team. You could call the Bird Celtics when they got Parrish and McHale, when they scarfed the Golden State. You could call that a super team. And so now modern players, and, you know, back to our empowerment discussions, you know, they're not dumb. They want to win. They want championships. They want a legacy. But not all players are created equal. So, you know, KD is something special, and we know that. And LeBron is something special, and we know that. And to some degree, you know, Bosch, you know, Bosch was quietly willing to play his role at the expense of his own fame and fortune. You know,
absolutely.
That not everyone. Yeah. So, but, you know, so these guys want what they've seen their, you know, their brethren before them do. You know, they want kind of the same thing, but, you know, sometimes you got to be careful what you wish for. Because for both Harden and Simmons now, they face a crucible, right? They've got another, it's another opportunity. So they go and see Drex. He's going to say, well, here we are again. Here's another opportunity. Now, what can you do with this one?
Yeah, and just for a sidebar, how good would Chris Bosh be in today's NBA? Just in the small amount of time in the grand scheme of things since he played, how the league has changed and what it's become. Like, mm-hmm. how good would that guy be? Oh, my God. Like, it would be scary.
We need a top 50 or 100. Maybe this is out there on the internet, but the top 50, top 100 of all time, who, if they played today, would be completely different players. You know,
that's a summertime gin and tonic pod.
That sounds like one.
Sit down and crank out top 50 if they play today. Because there's some guys who play without a three-point line that I'm pretty sure would average like 35 today.
Yeah.
So or could. That's interesting. I like that. We'll have to put a pin and come back to that. But it still rolls into this idea of acquiring talent versus developing talent. And another thing we were going to talk about, there's a lot of acquiring going on in the NBA. There's not a lot of teams developing the talent. They're allowing that talent to be developed somewhere else and then acquiring either a ready-made talent or a just a piece away talent. And immediately my brain goes to Andrew Wiggins, right? Who yep. spent all that time in Minnesota learning how to play basketball because he came in just as a talent. And Minnesota never gets to see the fruits of that labor because by the time he's actually an adult and a mature veteran in the NBA, but still only in his mid-20s, we got to ship him off and get somebody else in here who somebody else developed. Because we think that guy is ready and this guy is not. And so it's like these teams are just switching. They're playing chess with the pieces. And whoever has the strongest queen or king or whatever you want to, you know, whoever has that strongest one in the middle usually ends up with the checkmate at the end. Last year it was Giannis. This year, who knows who it'll be?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the analogy there is to small market, big market baseball. You know, so the Tampa Bay Rays develop talent, or the Florida Marlins, or whoever it is, develop talent. Milwaukee Brewers, I don't even think there is a Milwaukee Brewers anymore, but, develop these guys, and then when it comes time to pay the big money, they ship them off to the Yankees, the Red Sox, or the, you know, the Dodgers, or whomever. I think the NBA is similar because it only takes, you know, only takes a player or three to win at the highest level. And the big market teams, obviously, you know, notwithstanding the Knicks, have a knack for winning.
Yeah, I think the only issue becomes the salary cap, right? That's the only hindrance to it being the exact same, is that there's only so much the Lakers could do. Because they're up against it.
You know,
because they've given away all their draft picks, and right. At some point you've got to, you know, get some people in there for the future. So you just can't keep giving away your 2024 and 2025, and you know, playing for today. Because at some point the rent, you know, the check comes due.
Right, but the other way I was gonna go with it, right, is just look at the Celtics who just got rid of seven players and got back basically two with with Derek White from San Antonio, like a place that really develops players, if we want to look at it that way. Greg Popovich, they develop players that play the right way. And Daniel Theis, who was, you know, anyone that paid attention to the Celtics, I mean, Theis is just a terrific big, like a complimentary big. So in the in that case, right, Danny Ainge is acquiring talent, acquiring all these guys, not to, again, throw too much shade on Romeo Langford. Who I think did, and I put some shade there in previous episodes. So, and I think he, again, because I think he got out of town pretty now they're like articles where, okay, Brad, you know, obviously these articles are made to sell. So, you know, God knows how much truth is in it. But, you know, Brad shows you how much Brad Stevens thinks of the team that Danny Ainge assembled for him, because he just freaking sent, you know, half of it packing. So my point is, guess what? In the NBA, you know, you can go a long way with a couple of good players acquired or developed, and just acquiring players per se isn't enough, because then you need, you know, the pieces to fit.
Well, I mean, but the issue with the Celtics seems to be that the guys that they're developing, the ones that they put their money into and said, these are going to be the cornerstone guys that we developed ourselves, didn't get developed to the level that they need to be developed in order for the team to be a championship level team. That falls back on Brad Stevens. That's not Danny Ainge's fault.
Yeah. I mean, I would say to that, I would defend Stevens, and I would say, you know, they're relatively young, and young players may be thrown to the wolves a little bit. And, you know, if we go back just a couple of years, they were Eastern Conference, you know, finalists, et cetera, with Isaiah, you know, so I, you know, that one's pretty complicated. I think there's going to be books written on the rise, fall, and rise again of the Celtics. That one is
so
more than I can
predict. So you're predicting the rise again?
Big time. I'm on here to say right now, in a prediction, now that I'm making it, bound to blow up, as is our podcast tends to do, the Celtics are back in a big way in one of the great stories of the year. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm saying it. They're back. I never thought I'd see it. This thing has flipped 100%, and Coach Udoka gets all the credit in the world, as do the players, Brad Stevens, everyone in the organization, for not hitting the panic button, but making a couple of moves. They're going to turn out to be gigantic moves, and still leaves room for a star player to join the fold next summer as well. So it's even better than anything that's going to happen this year. Sorry that I can't, you know, that's, yep.
I have a question that I don't know if you have an answer to, but I want to hear your opinion on it. Do you believe that the Celtics can bring in a big name player, or not even a big name, a legitimate star?
Yes.
Based off of
both their history, of course, okay, but more relevant, the makeup of the team as presently constructed from coach through star players. So the answer, unequivocally, yes, and even more so, should they compete for an Eastern Conference title this year, which I think they're going to do.
Gotcha. See, I worry that – I don't worry, but I think that the Celtics find themselves in a situation where, because of how recent stars have viewed being in Boston, it's going to sour other stars on being in Boston, or at least being in Boston as a Celtics.
No, I think it's a what have you done for me lately league. I think we live in a what have you done for me lately society. I think you're raising a serious point, obviously, that gets a warranted conversation. But I think if I was guessing, that's not going to be the case. And if I wanted to interject, I'd say you're letting your depression, anxiety, and anger over the state of the Lakers, you know, you're trying to take me down with you, really, is all you're trying to do.
Oh, no, because just like you have bold proclamations, I myself think that that a lot of what we hear about the Lakers' demise is based off of the fact that it sells newspapers or in today's society gets clicks. You have an entire half of the season left. Well, not half, but you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of basketball left to play. If the Lakers go on an 8 out of 10 or a 10 out of 15 or 10 out of 14 run, they're right back in the thick of things. It's not as if there are teams that are uber dominant. We saw what happened when the Lakers decide, okay, this is a game we need to earmark, that we have to come to ball at. They play the Golden State Warriors, whom everyone has already given a title. It took a tap out 3-pointer from Klay Thompson in order to put them down. And if that's the best that you have before you get in front of playoff LeBron, you got problems. Because playoff LeBron is an entirely different animal than regular season LeBron. We've seen it now for, 15, 16 years? So I feel very good about the Lakers. And I think that whomever ends up with the one seed, they're praying that the Lakers don't end up in that playoff, that play-in game. They are begging the Lakers to get to 7 or get to 6, excuse me, so they don't have to be in that play-in game. They want no part of the Lakers in the first round. This is not last year where guys are coming right off of injury and you've got dudes that are more into getting their hair colored than playing basketball. You got guys who are basketball players on that team. And when it's time to play ball, and we get to, as they would call it, nut cutting time, it's going to be Lakers. And I feel very bullish on it. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Okay, cool. But I feel really good about the fact that they did not make a move. I thought that the panic button move would be to all of a sudden blow it all up and try to then reconfigure it again on the fly down the stretch. You put yourself in the situation that you put yourself in many years ago. Let's stay the course. Let's take these pieces. Let's get everybody healthy. Let's rearrange it all around, and let's find a combination. Let's find a tasty gumbo, and let's keep this thing moving. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the second half of the year.
And I'll tell you what you're not looking back at. 40 minutes in, and you haven't looked back at a Super Bowl that was just played that I told you no one would care about. In fact, so few people cared about it, you haven't even made mention of it in 43 minutes. And by the way, I did some research on an Olympic, I compared it to the China Olympics, which is currently 40% behind past viewership, 40% drop in viewership.
It's 10 million more than there were last year.
Yeah, well, it's 40%.
100 million.
We can make the numbers.
We can make them dance all we want. 100 million this year. 100 million people viewed it this year versus 90 million last year. To me, that says that last year had your guy, had the Golden Boy, had Tom Brady in it.
Right.
It had Tom Brady. And it had the new gun, the nouveau riche. The old gun versus the new gun, and it did 90 million. This year it did 100 million.
55 or 60 million of those people turned it on at halftime to watch the single greatest halftime show ever. So they weren't even watching the game. They turned it on at halftime.
We've already discussed that the Super Bowl is for the casuals. So
you did say that.
Of course they tuned in for halftime. And they should. I have it ranked as my third greatest all time.
I saw that. That's why I was propping it up big, because I saw that online presence yours, couldn't argue with too much of what I saw there. So
I appreciate
and then, you know, Yeah, but maybe what we'll do is we'll break that down a little bit next week or something, you know.
Well,
including my favorite ad, which, you know, as a casual fan, I was thinking the whole time, what's my favorite ad? So one of them was the Amazon mind reader thing. You know,
that was number one.
Your mind.
Number one.
Okay, that was my favorite. And then the other one, it was FTX. I watched it with Mary Beth. I didn't even know what the heck the advertisement was for. But it was a hell of a commercial. Something like FTX. I don't know what. I don't even know what the product was. But the commercial was great.
My second best was the Coinbase QR code bouncing on the screen for 30 seconds.
Okay.
And really quickly, like it got, like people were coming out. I can't believe they spent so much money on this. And oh my gosh, they didn't know what they were doing. And I just sat back and went, you're doing exactly what they wanted you to do. You're talking about it. Oh my gosh, it's a joke. The site crashed. Well, they probably crashed the site on purpose. Like all of this gets you talking about it. That's what they wanted. That's money well spent. You're the reverberation of an advertisement they were planning to run once and once only. And now you're just free advertisement after that. I really loved it. I thought it was genius. And it was risky because it could go wrong, but I thought it was genius. So some good stuff there. And I think that what we see and the reason why we haven't talked a lot of, you know, NFL is because everybody's been talking NFL. You know, it's like, okay, well,
we don't like to talk about what everyone's talking about.
Yeah. We don't want to zig when everybody else zigs. We want to zag. We like to zag. Okay. Speaking of zags, you know, Gonzaga's back to number one again. If we're doing a college hoops check-in, Gonzaga's back to number one. Auburn's back to down to two. Gonzaga's looked really impressive. They looked really good versus St. Mary the other night. St. Mary, who has one of the best defenses in the country. They also take the air out of the ball like no other. They play some of the most boring basketball I've ever seen in my entire life. And they do so with a vigor. By the way, if my boy Hunter is paying attention, I'm sorry, man. Your squad is they're boring. Your squad is boring. And they don't care because they're trying to win. And I can't blame them for that.
Yeah, and they got to play a little differently than Gonzaga if they're going to do it, you know. So they play a little differently.
You got to zig if Gonzaga's zagging, because if you don't, you're going to get blown out by 50, which is what BYU did a few nights before when they tried to do what Gonzaga did and realized they're not Gonzaga.
Yeah, so. I do think, you know, it goes back to early season predictions that the thing is as wide open as it's ever been. That's my take on college basketball. There's you know, probably 15 teams that have a legit chance to win it. And definitely that many to get to the Final Four, if not more. So I think it's as wide open as ever. And the Duke conspiracy people will be out in force as they try to push Duke to Coach K's final dance. But we'll see what happens.
I'll be interested to see what happens there. On the prep front, a good friend of mine, we go way back, Tom Nelson, continuing to do his thing down at Bremer in May. I think he's zeroing in on a milestone for wins for him. Also, if you look around the landscape of college basketball, especially in the Northeast, you can't find a team that hasn't been touched by a player that he's coached. So I want to take this opportunity to salute him and what he's done in his time at Bremer in May and his time with MASH Rivals, help me out.
Vinny P.
You know, like with what he's done and what they've been able to do down there has been remarkable. Their fingerprints are all over Providence, as we talked about Providence a lot, and what Ed Cooley has been able to do. A lot of what Ed Cooley's doing is with guys that have played for Tom Nelson
in one capacity or another, either at Bremer May or on MASH Rivals or both. And, you know, the same at Boston College.
Tom Nelson is a good man as well as a hell of a good coach. And, you know, one of the things he's done both with the Rivals and Bremer is he has developed players. So that's the bottom line. He has done it the right way, continues to do it the right way. I'm sure he's going to keep doing it the right way for a long time. And you certainly don't want to play one of his experienced teams that has talent, because then you're in for a just a sheer rock fight. But you always want to challenge yourself against the best. So, Tom, I look forward to our future contests.
Absolutely, and I'm sure we'll have to get him on the pod, have him come and join us and talk a little ball. You know, talk a little bit about, you know, about that trophy culture that you were talking about earlier. Hobart update. We got a big game tonight. Matter of fact, if people
when you're 4 minutes to tip off, four minutes to tip off,
and we're gonna get you out of there. What is it looking like? A quick review.
Quick review. They play a team tonight. They got a win. They got three left. They play tonight at home. They just played the same team on this past Saturday and beat them. So we got a quick turnaround. This other team probably wanting to spoil any Hobart chances for postseason. Then we've got two home games over the weekend with the top two teams in the league, and a good chance Hobart needs to get both of those to make the playoffs too. Certainly need to win two of the next three. So I'm a little geeked up. If in case someone someone accuses me of saving my energy tonight a little bit, it's probably because I'm saving some for this ball game I'm about to watch.
Absolutely. Cheers to you and good luck to Professor LeJour as he embarks on another playoff run. And ladies and gentlemen, that has been another episode of the Zebra Stripes podcast, episode 11, we think.
The last 10 or 11, so I'm calling it 12.
You're calling it 12? We never actually, I guess we never actually went and checked to see what.
Well, you were right. I think it's really 11, but since we went 10 or 11 the last time, I thought, well, this is 12, and, you know,
Or it could be 11, we think, and then next episode will be definitely 12.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Okay, I like it. Ladies and gentlemen, please make sure that you like and subscribe. Catch us wherever you get your podcast from. Make sure you follow Wit on social media at Wit LeJour. You can follow me at Gene Clemens. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, y'all be easy. Peace.